There's nothing quite like being a skeptic of this utterly rigged game than being like surrounded by people who are like full of hope in it at that time. Like they can't hear it, you know. It doesn't matter that 300,000 people got purged from Georgia's voter rolls, and that's the reason why Georgia has a right-wing governor. You know, it doesn't matter that felons can't vote. It doesn't matter that the voting machines in Texas were changing from Cruz to, I mean, from O'Rourke to Cruz. You know, it doesn't matter that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, now that they have a majority, the Democratic Party's first order of business is to reach across the aisle and usher in an era of bipartisanship with the guy they've been calling a fascist. It does none of that matters right now. You're supposed to hope, and you're supposed to pull that lever, and that's all that matters.
Hello and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And today we are diving back in to fascism, the
Sounds
topic.
fun.
So this is our post-fascism part two episode, because I think that we did a pretty decent job of breaking down what fascism was classically. But we didn't really have much of a chance to dig into the modern neo-fascist, post-fascist, fascist adjacent, and movements that come out of fascism. And
The
I think we
post-fascist matrix.
the post-fascist matrix, to quote Enzo Traverso. And I think that it would be good for us to talk about that a little bit, to sort of break down what separates the modern rightists from classical fascism, because we need to figure out a way to oppose them. And it turns out that getting guns and barricading the streets and, fighting against the fascist militias that don't exist isn't going to help us.
Right, yeah.
Not yet. Right. Well, Richard Spencer swears he's not a Nazi, and
Well, he's
he
not a
might.
German in the 1930s, so
I was gonna say,
Right.
yeah, he might have a point.
He is not a member of the National Socialist Workers' Party, German Workers' Party. But that's actually something I've seen online that rightists say is like the left is super worried about a party that hasn't existed since 1945, while we have communists and anarchists in the streets doing the real violence.
I love that as like a slogan, like doing the real violence.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be a good Antifa electoral slogan.
Somebody who's good at the internet needs
Antifa.
to get on that.
Doing the
Doing the
real
real violence.
violence. Yeah. I'd wear that shirt. But yeah, I mean, there, Richard Spencer has a point. He's not a member of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. But you know what he is, though, is a sort of anti-capitalist who
Right.
Is a white nationalist at the same time. So he's just about as close as you get to a Nazi in the United States, right? Because
I mean,
even like
he's the person who coined the term alt-right, or at least he takes credit for it. And
Right.
maybe he only takes credit for it like in the way that Gene Simmons takes credit for devil horns. But
Oh,
at any
right.
rate, he popularized the term alt-right, and he I think we should take him at his word that he believes that he's, putting forward a new set of far-right politics, which, we identify within the post-fascist matrix.
Yeah, and
Absolutely.
in any way about it, he is a figurehead of sorts, for a new movement that consciously that is consciously rebranding itself.
Right.
Is very aware of the unpopularity of things like the idea of ethnic cleansing and the word fascism and the name Nazi, and but want to rehabilitate the underlying philosophy of these perspectives.
I just like that he's most famous for having gotten punched in the side of the head.
Yep. So Richard Spencer has actually said that he's for universal health care and sort of a nanny state type of democratic socialism for white people.
For a white ethnostate, yeah.
For a white ethnostate, and he believes in a peaceful ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
Which,
just like, you know, just like Mussolini believed in a peaceful, competitive foreign policy.
Right, exactly.
He's also a huge critic of the Euroscepticism of the European neo-fascist movements, because he
thinks there should be a unified European movement.
Yeah, he's Europeanist, essentially. Like
that's the difference between like American white identitarianism and the sort of classical racial hierarchies of European fascism, right? Because in the U.S., you blend it all together and you just create this thing like whiteness. And so we have this really funny situation where Richard Spencer thinks that there should be a white Euro ethno state like the EU, but just without immigrants. And it's the existence of EU rules, which, so Poland kicked him out and now he can't go anywhere in the EU. Because the EU does kind of function in some way similar to the way he wishes it did.
You know how bummed out I would be if I got kicked out of Europe? And I'm not even like a fucking European supremacist. I bet that ruined his fucking day.
I don't even think Europe's done a lot of cool shit lately.
Oh no, not really.
No, I mean the coolest things about Europe are, like, you know, going to visit its historical sites, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I like Europe, is because of all the stuff that used to be cool about it. That's actually worth talking about, is the ethnic supremacy movements in Europe, which differ completely from the American version of those same sort of things. And I was mentioning this to Jason earlier, is that Europe has sort of post-fascist movements that have their actual roots in the former fascist parties that either collaborated with the Nazis, in the case of the Front National in France, with the, you know, the neo-Nazis in Germany. They've got their roots deeply in those movements, and they identify with them. Whereas in the United States, they're much more amorphous and never really openly identify with the fascist movements of Europe. But, okay, so basically what I'm saying is that the American version of the European movements is much like the European movements, but just fucking dumber.
Yeah, it's more like maybe I want to pose this actually as a question rather than a statement, which is that, is it, in your opinion, it's more like the faith, the, what do they fucking call it? The health, wealth, and prosperity gospel movement, like that, like that's more so its social base?
Oh, absolutely. That's, you know, I hadn't even thought about that really, but there's
the evangelicals, you know, the middle class, white, conservative.
Right. I mean, the alt-right movement in the United States, they don't want an ethnically homogenous United States. They want the imposition of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant values and identity upon everyone else. So, weirdo Catholics and, you know, people with ethnic-sounding last names who speak other languages, like other white European languages that aren't English, you know, they're not included in that group either. Jews are white Europeans as well. They aren't excluded in it the way that the European movements excluded Jews in the, you know, in the 30s and 40s and focused on them. But they are, you know, included in that culture. In fact, it's like, if you ever look at Jewish people who are part of the alt-right engaging online with other alt-righters, you'll notice that other alt-righters refer to that person. They'll just say like, yeah, that's a good point, Jew.
It's kind of like, you know, boy.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, we live in the same town, but it's pretty clear who's, you know, at the top of the heap.
Like, that was almost a direct quote. Yeah, that's a good point, Jew. Because that's something I saw in, like, a discussion between all writers online.
Chris, what was the term that you used before about that kind of the phenomenon in which the fascist movement harkens to a sort of an imaginary, mythologized past?
Oh, the revolutionary palingenesis, the
Palingenesis.
Palingenesis, that means like rebirth, you know, like rebirth right. of an back to an idealized past that didn't actually necessarily exist, you know. I mean, that is one of the founding tenets of libertarianism.
Well, I was going to say, like, there's not a clean segue here anymore, but you know, when we're talking about the modern alt-right and neo-fascism or post-fascism, whatever, in the United States, and the way you said it before, 2 weeks ago, that there's like a clean through line through the libertarian movement into the alt-right, and that's not a mistake, right? Because the, I already forgot the word.
Palingenesis?
Right. Because the palingenesis of the American far right isn't an era of like a centralized state with a powerful leader and or any of that stuff. It's the mythologized past of the yeoman farmer who has domain over his slaves and has, you know, fended off the uncivilized tribes that used to inhabit the area, whatever. The libertarian ethos and the American fascist ethos are the same, which is why they're able to say, oh, we're not fascists. We don't want a centralized government that tells you what to do, whatever. It's like, no, you want to be a government unto yourself. And you like the tyrant that you want to impose on the world is the property owner over his like small domain. It's a petty fascism.
Right.
Well. Yeah, and it's an easy slide from there to, like, well, here's a really powerful dude who's going to, you know, make that happen, make it a reality.
Well, sure. I mean, they want a Jefferson Davis.
Yeah.
So the...
they just don't want a Hitler.
The whole palingenesis thing, the extent to which that exists in the modern far right, in the modern fascist, post-fascist matrix, that's pretty universal. That exists in the Front National in France. You know, they call back the days of the true French Republic, right? That exists in the Hungarian, like Viktor Orban. You know, that exists. I know the Polish and all of the German ones and the American groups down to the mainstream Republican Party has a mythologized past that it harkens back to.
Right. It's the Jacksonian and Jeffersonian era of the American Republic. Cultured brutes that, like, you know, they're like wild frontiersmen, but they also are like genteel. Because they're the planter class and all
right.
that stuff.
And that...
So they look like such fucking dorks trying to, you know, talk about Western civilization and anime.
Well, yeah, modernism is a disease. And then, like, they're, you know, then they post, like, tentacle porn.
Why? What? That is so... incompatible, so patently incompatible. Like, there are so many things that are incompatible about so many things that exist in the world, and I get that, you know, we're all full of contradictions, but that one just seems so strange, yet so consistent.
It comes out of Gamergate.
It's just like nerds on the internet are into anime and are also the ones who... are in the appeal to this like idea of the world sucks and everything would be better if, you know, white
if
men were
I was if I was assigned if there was a white government that assigned me a virgin wife.
Well, that's the 21st century version of being a planter and having everybody work on your land while you sit around and read, you know, in Homer in the original Greek is, you know, you have a UBI and you get the game and watch tentacle porn. But it's functionally, it's the same thing in terms of like the sort of the ideological kind of cultural lubricant that keeps this whole machine
so,
running.
So, I mean, there are, of course, and I think this is sort of a false, a straw man that is brought up against people who talk about the origins of the online alt-right being in 4chan and gaming communities. They're like, oh, no, it's not. It's in the material circumstances of the collapse of, you know, American capitalism and our political system, blah, 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 you know, that shit. It's like, yeah, of course it fucking is, right? Absolutely it is. But where was rightist ideology given to these people? Where did they congregate and discuss this ideology? And that's in these political groups on 4chan. So that not all people who the alt-right appeals to are gamers, but this core, this like the elite shock troops of shit posting on the internet who create the racist memes and turn on lots of people to this type of politics, they were incubated in 4chan and they come out of Gamergate.
Right. It's like not all Nazis were the Schutzstaffel, but the elite of the movement, you know, they have a particular kind of cultivation that allows them to be, to be that.
Yeah. So like Nagel's got her problems and her analysis isn't 100% spot on. But what she does do is correctly trace the origins of the anime Nazi, the online anime Nazi, back to Gamergate and political threads on 4chan.
Right. And the way that the internet developed as a forum is obviously tied to the death of the sort of utopian culture of modernism, and the material undergirding of that is neoliberalism. And obviously there are, you know, economic engines which you could say at a base that help sort of provide a superstructure ideologically or whatever, but like that's what that is. That's what the 4chan and Reddit and now Twitter, weird Twitter world is it's today's version of what maybe in a different period might have been a beer hall or a salon,
right?
Or whatever.
We've situated palingenesis in the modern post-fascist movements. Some of the other things that I think are important to think about when we're trying to talk about the differences between post-fascism and classical fascism are idealist notions of anti-materialism and voluntarism, which I think that the modern post-fascist movements lack. There doesn't seem to be that voluntarist ideal in the mainstream post-fascist movements. Like, there isn't the idea that, you know, the will of the movement is going to break the chains of the old world and bring into the open a new one.
Yeah, I wonder about that a lot. And I wonder if that's just because of the wasteland that is the neoliberal 21st century. Because the left is afflicted by similarly low horizons,
yeah,
and a sort of a lack of the kind
total
of
death of utopia.
Yeah, and right, and so for the left, you know, it's a different kind of primary engine. It's a different kind of motivating.
I mean, just think of the heroes of the fascist movements in the past, right? Benito Mussolini, who was a soldier and somewhat of intellect. He was a newspaper editor. He's a great public speaker. And then Hitler.
Oh, he's like one of the great orators.
Hitler, who was
also
a soldier who was wounded in combat and is also a great public speaker. You know, and Francisco Franco, who was a general. And then you compare the leader, the God Emperor Trump, as the alt-right refers to him, is this fucking sniveling, rich, trust fund, like, the softest human being alive who can barely string a coherent sentence together. And he is he's their leader. He's their duce, you know? And that's
right. Hitler could lay claim to high culture, even being like a painter.
Yeah.
And, like somebody who had command of not just the ability to command the spoken word in a way, which is motivating, but that he knew what it was that spoke to the intellectual side of German nationalism. You know, he knew the points of reference, and you know, he was like personally involved in like reminding and like popularizing Wagner,
yeah,
and
right,
you know, promoting this kind of like appropriation of Nietzsche and stuff. Like, do you think Donald Trump's read an entire fucking book?
No, he definitively
absolutely
hasn't.
Fucking not.
I feel like that's got to speak profound. It has to. It speaks profoundly to a really fundamental difference to the sort of post-fascist stage that we're in from the original fascist roots, where the at its origins it truly aspired to greatness, and now it seems its primary aspiration is to get a fucking rise out of the libs, to troll the libs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the same depressing political landscape that has produced a group of self-identified socialists who have all of their hopes wrapped up in people running as Democrats are the same. It's the same political landscape that created a complete fucking just idiot who's probably in the early stages of dementia, and they lionize that. That's who they lionize. You know what I mean? That's their personification of the will of the white race. You know, that's their Ubermensch.
But right, like, okay, so we talked about this before with classical fascism as a reaction to the socialist movement developing the fangs of Bolshevism and becoming such a threat to the established order of the world, that it would responded in kind, essentially, right? So is it possible that, or I guess maybe what I would, maybe it seems to me that in the present moment, the alt-right, this kind of post-fascist development in the United States is responding more or less in kind to the development of a new left in this country, which is just like it's not on the scale. It's not on the same charts. It's an exciting, you know, sure, it's great that there's a new left that's growing, and I'm like very happy to be a part of it or whatever. But it does not have in its point of origin, like the seizure of state power.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Or like the ending of a war. Or even like a city, like national general strike, or anything of its kind. It's like we have two sort of pale echoes of the past that are both kind of grappling, you know, in opposite directions from each other, but grappling toward the new, but still being very much burdened by the past. And I think it's the inability to kind of like, I think the inability to articulate itself as clearly as classical fascism has to have something to do with its mirror opposite having a similar problem.
Damn, that was really, really profound.
That's what I came here to do.
Another characteristic of classical fascism is the idea of a new authoritarian and nationalist state. Like the sweeping away of the old state and the establishment of a new state, which I don't think applies. I mean, there are actual people who believe in fascism that would like to see an authoritarian fascist dictatorship in the United States, right? Obviously. But I think that the most of the post-fascist groups, like going back to the Front National as the primary example, they claim to be democratic, right? They claim to want to uphold the integrity of the republic. And that's what the post-fascist groups in the United States would like to do as well, is uphold the integrity of the republic as they see fit, the way the founders intended it.
Right, right.
Right, it's taking off some of the additions, like the Voting Rights Act, or,
yeah,
you know, the fact that you can't have a poll tax anymore, or whatever. Like,
non-land-owning non-white men are allowed to vote at all.
Right, or even something like that, let's say, somewhat more abstracted from the like overtly fascistic tendencies of the alt-right or the American Republican Party is like the imposition of the Federal Reserve, right? As like the one of the progressive era's like great sins against the classical republic is like that's the sort of backdoor into the Jew banker conspiracy.
Yeah, it is.
Right.
Like the Federal Reserve and fiat currency. And it's like the birth of globalism, and that you know, we've got a lot of people in the U.S. Congress that talk about this stuff as if it's very normal. Like fucking Rand Paul, who is gets elected by seemingly normal humans all the time.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Moving on. Okay, we talked about this a little bit last week. Opposition to finance capital and sort of the post-fascist right in the United States specifically has no opposition to to gigantic corporations and to finance capital and to or any of that stuff. They see themselves being that one day. You know, they see themselves being the CEO of whatever company one day. And they lionize people that they lionize speculators and, you know, people like Donald Trump, who never produced a single thing in their life. That's one of the things about the fascists, is they agreed. Yeah. They all, it was sort of a founding principle of the fascist movement, and it the same in all of them, is this idea that they're the productive classes, is what they called them, of the nation needed to work in concert.
Right.
So the that necessarily excludes bankers and real estate speculators and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
Like stock market traders, anybody who makes their money without laboring in some way, at least.
Yeah, it's
in
the sectors
like
are called the sectors are called FIRE, finance, insurance, and real estate. Those are the three non-productive sectors that exist solely
to make money off of money
extracting.
Yeah,
exactly. Extracting wealth.
Yo, those sectors are pretty fire, though.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is something that definitely, that very important descriptor of classical fascism does not exist in the post-fascist milieu. Let's see. Oh, the positive evaluation and just the glorification of violence for the sake of violence. I think that exists.
That's definitely there. I mean, in the absence of like the street militia that just goes around harassing the otherized undesirable elements of societies, you just have periodic, episodic, you know, like mass shootings or whatever.
That and the
street brawls in Portland, at least,
and like lamest version of that being the Proud Boys.
Oh, that's true. We can't forget the Proud Boys.
Can you imagine, you know, joining up with the Sturmabteilung? So what do I got to do in order to be a member of the SA? It's like, oh, well, first of all, you can't jack off. And you have to name all these breakfast cereals. And we're all going to slap you a bunch to initiate you.
And you have to wear this one kind of shirt.
Well, they did that.
Yeah, but it was
a brown
uniform,
one.
You know?
Yeah.
They had a paramilitary uniform and culture. It wasn't like a
not a polo.
A polo shirt.
Also, if you look at someone like, you know, like Ernst Röhm, who's like scarred up and just fucking tough as shit looking, or like Walter Stennisch, who like commanded the Berlin SA, who's just like this dashing sort of like Napoleonic hero looking figure. And then you look at fucking Gavin McInnes, he's your leader. This like,
yeah.
He's like, if
it's
stereotypical epic bacon guy, you know?
No, it's all so much more farcical.
It's a pastiche of the fucking fascist street militias of the 20th century.
Well, it's like even the right is spectacular in this era, where like, you know, maybe we like to, on the left, sometimes we think we're doing more than we're doing, with our like culture of opposition being so like perfectly narrowly defined and like sold back to us by the system, you know. That rebellion has been recuperated and whatever. Like, I think maybe it's because a full fascist Leviathan isn't necessary. That it also, since it hasn't developed beyond a similar kind of like LARPing dweebiness,
right?
Of just like, yeah, like this kind of like what replaces the SA's paramilitary, or like the black shirts kind of like, you know, like dashing kind of thuggish young men, you know, acting out like Roman centurion fantasies or whatever. Today it's like, it's just like bro culture turned up to 11. It's like barely different than just being in a frat.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely have that sort of thing going on in the on the left as well. You know, there is an element of LARPing that comes along with putting a bandana over your mouth and or wearing a fucking hammer and sickle shirt and carrying red flags at a protest and wearing fatigues like some leftist organizations do. Okay, so this is interesting. The goal of empire, expansion, that doesn't necessarily exist in the United States, nor in, you know, France or, you know, any of the other countries. I think that the right of a nation to conquer its neighbors or expand its territory that existed in the 20th century, it all had something to do with unmet expectations of the nationalists at the end of World War I, specifically in Italy and in Germany. Like, in Italy, Italy assumed that they were going to take back territory in the former Yugoslavia, or take back territory that the Austrians had, and take territory in Africa that was historically supposed to be Italian or whatever, in their eyes. And in Germany, obviously, they lost World War I. So these frustrated expectations of national expansion turned into a part of the drive for the fascist movements. It's what they wanted to accomplish once they seized power. In the United States, we don't really have that. And it doesn't seem to be part of the neo-fascist or the post-fascist movements in Europe as well. In fact, in the United States specifically, you have fascists as being isolationist and wanting to get out of other people's business, in specifically Syria's, or, you know, they want us to stop giving money to South Korea and get troops out of South Korea. It's more of an paleoconservative isolationism than it is fascism.
Yeah.
Do you think that is a distinction in the nature of the contemporary sort of past, the contemporary alt-right from traditional fascism? Or do you think that is a distinction in the interests and needs of capitalism in the modern world versus its interests and needs in the early 1900s?
Well, I think that the interests and needs of neoliberalism still very much include a robust military that's able to impose itself upon other countries. So that, as far as the alt-right having ideas that are against that, are definitely in direct conflict with the neoliberal project of imperialism.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I sort of think that, like, the classical fascist movement was, you know, it was the inheritor of a version of the, it was carrying forward a banner from the politics of the 19th century and the birth of the modern world in the first place, like the coalescing of disparate communities into the nation state, which required national identification being defined in some way. You know, the history of like wars of conquest in Europe and the way in which, like, kind of every generation bore the stamp in some way of what came before it. Like, there's a continuity all throughout. Just like fascism had these points of reference, for the Spanish, it was the Spanish Empire or whatever, and that goes back, and the glory of, like, the Roman Catholic Church and whatever. And there's just, like, this rupture, I think. There's, like, this, like, lack of continuity in the, from the sort of late 20th century onward, we're just in such a different kind of world. Like, there isn't a, in the era of spectacle, in the era of late capitalism, in the neoliberal postmodern world, like, what is it precisely that is supposed to be the sort of grand tradition that's being carried forward? Like, what was the last time the United States fought, like, a war of conquest that was, like, this glorious episode that has been, like, heralded? And I mean, I guess we do that in our movies and stuff about Afghanistan, but it's just not quite the same thing as, like, I mean, we've seen fascistic themes trotted out in American popular culture, like in, like, the movie, like, 300 or whatever, but it's really, like, just so much different. It's
incredibly different, and I suppose this is sort of what this is sort of what I mean. You know, fascism rose in a time when there were actually existing variant potential futures of, you know, rising imperial powers competing with each other for dominance in a global system. And the world we're living in now is one that has long since passed the point of a multiplicity of competing rival imperial powers, and only, you know, what was it, the last, like, 30 years, has since collapsed into a single monopoly of imperial power being in the United States. And there being some contradictions, the fascist movements, the nationalistic movements that you're going to see in various countries around the world are not going to be ones that are championing their own countries becoming, you know, the great imperial power. You're going to see ones that are recognizing a sort of like a national interest in securing their place in a global order that is sits them near the top, but there's not a national vying for global dominance anymore. And even the United States is living in a sort of contradiction of its own imperial dominance, you know, where,
yeah,
on the one hand it needs to maintain its position, but on the other hand it suffers from so many negative unintended consequences of it.
So, I mean, there are obviously places where that is not true, like specifically Israel and Russia, where the, you know, neo-fascists in those countries or the far-right nationalists in those countries definitely feel as though they have a right to someone else's territory because it is historically part of theirs, you know? Like Russia, yeah, probably feels like they have a right to the entire former Soviet Union and definitely attempts to be the dominant power in that area. And neo-fascists or post-fascists like Alexander Dugin have a whole ideology based around what they call Eurasianism, which is the dominance of Russia in a sort of European Union type of structure. And that is definitely part of the post-fascist project in Russia.
Yeah, and I guess the same is true in Israel, where Greater Israel includes, like, Sinai and
parts of Mesopotamia. And yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I guess it's all got its own character in a place-by-place basis. And I guess I could concede that maybe that might not be a something that distinctly separates fascism from post-fascism, because I guess it's sort of more like a national variation. It could be seen as like a national variation. Because, I mean, if you really think about it, Spain and Portugal didn't really care too much about reclaiming their former colonies. They just wanted to smash the left in their own countries and bring about stability.
Well, Portugal fights colonial wars in Angola and is it Mozambique?
Yeah, but that's not particularly fascist. That's just something that colonial powers do.
Well, sure. I mean, yeah. Yeah, they had a colonial empire and they tried to hold on to it. And right. Like the relationship between the anti-colonial struggle and the Carnation Revolution, which overthrows the Portuguese state, like is.
I mean, that's something that we do in the United States, regardless of who's president, is fuck up the Puerto Ricans. You know,
that's one of the things we do best.
All right, so the fascists were extremely anti-liberal, anti-communist. And initially, they stated that they were anti-conservative, as in they were against the old reactionary class that wanted to keep things the way they were, you know. So I think that sort of characterization of fascism lines up perfectly with modern post-fascism. Post-fascists in the United States specifically are very anti-liberal. Very anti-communist. In fact, anti-communist to the point where they see communists everywhere, right?
Everything is a cultural Marxist plot. Like, right. Everything.
and anti-conservative in the sense that they are against neoconservatism. They are against the conservatism that wants to keep, to maintain the status quo. They want to topple those conservatives. And
but the mainstream conservative movement in the U.S. is against conservative in that sense, in the sense of maintaining the status quo. It seems to me, at least in the things that I see as I look at like the judiciary system in the United States, the conservatives in at least that segment of society, and it seems to carry out more widely, is that they used to be in a position of trying to stop change through upholding the way things have always been. But now it seems that the reactionaries that make up the mainstream Republican Party want to move things backwards. They are dissatisfied with the way that things are currently are.
Yeah. I think that the alt-right and the post-fascist movement in the United States, though, would like a much more radical change in the way things are than mainstream conservatism would. I think the alt-right would be totally okay with criminalizing certain things that are dear to liberalism, such as protest and speaking ill of the president and stuff like that. These things that I think that even mainstream conservatives would probably be against in certain instances, you know.
Well, those are the cuckservatives.
Yes, that's what they call them, cuckservatives.
That's what they call them, right? These are like conservatives who have been so emasculated by the dominant cultural liberalism that they've lost their capacity to really like stand against that sort of right, the cultural Marxist tide, right? Those are the cuckservatives. They're people who, let's say, they imagine that they desire the same things as the true conservatives, right? But they've just been so thoroughly cucked that they can't stand for anything. All they can do is kind of simper about how they've been losing the culture war. Until, you know, until this new epoch where the conservative movement is on the offensive. And now there's this cleavage between the two of the neocons and the post-fascists or whatever.
We talked a bit about this last week, where like the ideas of mass mobilization and the militarization of the party. Well, first of all, the party doesn't exist in most post-fascist groupings, like Bolsonaro in Brazil. The idea of like a mass party with its, you know, newspapers and party militia and mass rallies and stuff like that doesn't exist in the way that it did with classical fascism. But as far as the Front National is concerned, it's your typical parliamentary party. Same with Bolsonaro's party. It's very much just an attempt. It's a vehicle for a person to get their ideas into parliament and into the mainstream.
I was just going to say, but isn't Bolsonaro sort of somewhat distinct in exactly that regard, in that he gladly uses parliamentarianism, but at least seems to very seriously threaten its continued existence?
Sure, I mean, he would like to threaten existence of parliamentarianism, but he is coming to power in a coalition of people who hope he's just being rhetorical, you know? Which actually is what Mussolini and Hitler did too.
Yeah.
Right. That's sort of what I'm thinking.
Yeah, but he doesn't have a party that he can use to threaten and bludgeon other conservatives in his coalition into falling in line.
Yeah, he just appeared from obscurity, a lot like Trump.
Right.
The same thing afflicts the left around the world in terms of the death of the party form as like the mass organization of the class through which, like, you know, the movement finds its physical and its spiritual expression. Like in France, you have a more vital left, a more sort of vibrant left than you do in maybe in this country, right? But the primary vehicle is Les France Insoumise and the campaigns of Jean-Luc Mélenchon but these are parliamentary vehicles that they don't have like a daily life like the old workers' parties had in between the electoral cycle. And so like the far right has the same this sort of mirror existence as basically it's like the mass political form is like a very dormant thing. It's like politics itself. Politics is non-existent. And this is it's a thing that people are trying to return to, right? Like there are people inside the British Labour Party who are trying to turn labor into like a social movement vehicle more akin to a classical Labour Party. But that's kind of a thing that's an outlier. That like generally speaking, politics as collective expression of like, you know, the aspirations of a movement, that's not a thing that exists for people anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of those things that like I want to explore in, at a future date, like the sort of operating thesis of the Situationist project. I think is so so accurate about just the way in which life has been so completely altered.
I would be into
just
that.
Fundamentally different. Yeah,
that's a good way to close that out. Let's move on to the next characteristic. Okay, so one of the most important things to the classical fascists was the style and organization of the movement. The mass party, the mass mobilization included uniforms, symbols, a liturgy, like a political liturgy, and you know. That included the glorification of mystical aspects of the ideology, glorifying the strong male, like ideal male form, the exaltation of youth and virility as embodied by youthful, strong, aesthetically pleasing young men specifically, you know. It's all very homoerotic, really, if you think about it. But but yeah, so style, style and presentation was incredibly important. And the mass rally as sort of like political theater that involved everyone in the party, something that they can be involved in. All of that was incredibly important to the fascist movement. And, you know, Trump has his rallies, but they're more speaking engagements, like fundraisers, speaking engagements, than they are like mass political rallies with, you know, uniforms and chanting and a political liturgy and stuff like that. So in my opinion, that's one thing that separates the post-fascists from the fascists. And I think that's kind of, I mean, it's not necessarily like a politically important distinction so much as it is just an expression of that same thing that we were talking about before, of the lack of that party, of that mass party,
right?
You know?
Well,
right, right.
I think it might be a politically more important distinction than it first appears, because, like, in as much as like politics is dead, and like absent from people's lives, the closest sort of approximation to like mass politics that we've seen in this country in a while is Trump's ability to like perpetually rile up his base as if it was like campaign season. For two full years now, right?
Right.
And that's a very bizarre thing to witness for, like, the liberal commentariat. And they're like, why is he still campaigning? Campaigning season is over, right? Because that's the only way that we understand politics. It's like you're campaigning for votes, and now you got the votes, and now you got the power, whatever. And so
when you've had an actual neo-fascist like Steve Bannon advising you, though, and you're Trump,
right?
You know what to do, you know?
And it's that's the real reason why, you know, like only Sanders could have defeated Trump, actually, like at the level of psychology, you know, because we do talk about the popularity of certain political policy proposals, whatever. And those things are true, like that people identify with Medicare for all and for $15 an hour or whatever. But I think that there's something deeper that that I think is probably worth us investigating as a movement in the, you know, as a left in the future, is the psychology the return of the mass psychology, or the Jody Dean thesis about party and crowd, that like the ability to perpetually mobilize is like a distinct feature maybe of the old fascism, and it's also of the old left, right? Of the old workers' movement. It is not a feature of modern politics. In as much as we see it at all, we see it in this weird kind of like zombified form in Donald Trump's support base, whatever. But again, it's like that.
Right, the thing it lacks is not it's not the mass politics character. The thing that it lacks is the party discipline character.
Well, it lacks the participation of politics of the 20th century. It's still spectacle. It's still like a sporting event, you know? I think like it's still the case that politics, even this kind of like this sort of quasi mass politics of in the Trump era, it's still spectacle, right? Like it's still you don't participate. Like the ownership and participation of being involved in a part of a political movement in the 20th century, that's not a feature of this landscape. You still engage in politics as a spectator, like the way that you do at a sporting event.
Right.
So it's like lively. Yeah, exactly. The base is whipped up and in a frenzy and more actively consuming the message or whatever. But at the Nuremberg rallies, you know, you were like, they gave you books to throw in and you carried the flags around and you dressed up for it and you like, you know, you made sure to look a certain way. And it was like, it was a thing that you engaged in and you took ownership of. And certainly for like the old left in the labor movement, that like, you know, the songs and the pageantry and all the camaraderie of being involved in this collective experience together, that is not a feature of American politics today or modern politics, I think anywhere in it. And once again, this is the thing I guess I keep coming back to in this conversation, is it's just as much a feature of being on the left in this kind of atomized sort of passive spectator role that you play, as it is a feature of, well, it's just this is daily life in this era.
Right. It's also worth noting too that the fascist movements of old, when compared specifically to the American phenomenon, not only had a leadership that was actively involved in the fascist movement, unlike Trump, who's kind of like sort of been hoisted to the forefront of the movement without him having any sort of say in it.
that's true.
Was an active ideological supporter of the movement, like, you know, leader of the movement. Like Hitler was a firm believer in the things that he said, and Mussolini really did want to bring his people and the nation back to the forefront of the world stage and create a new Roman Empire and have, like, you know, a harmonious, like, homogenous sort of national life. Whereas Trump doesn't actually, I think, even believe anything, you know, at all. Yeah. 100% completely cynical in using. I mean, he used to be a Democrat, right? And now he's a Republican, I guess.
He's just kind of whatever
he needs to be, given his particular context. Like he doesn't have any beliefs at all. It's just, you know, he lived in New York City, and to be involved in politics,
and you know, in New York City. You know what those types are like.
those fucking degenerates.
Well, so this makes me wonder about, you know, there are things that I don't know about political figures like Marine Le Pen or Viktor Orban as the sort of the expressions of a more pronounced and articulate politics on the far right. Like, you know, Oswald Mosley in the British Union of Fascists was like, this is not like a careerist guy who seized upon a moment in order to kind of like get ahead in life like Donald Trump or like a whole lot of far right politicians like Bolsonaro, probably. Like Mosley died penniless, as far as I know, and he went to jail for his political activities, and, you know, he sacrificed his reputation and whatever as a... He was a Hitler figure without a Hitler moment, but he was still a person who was dedicated to a cause and, like, genuinely lived and breathed the cause. Not to say admirable, right? But it's just to say authentic.
There is absolutely nothing authentic about Trump whatsoever. And I actually don't think there's anything authentic about Bolsonaro either.
Right. I kind of feel like that Bolsonaro is just Trump more unleashed, more unhinged, more free, and thus maybe like a glimpse into the future of this country.
I think potentially significantly more rooted in the military.
Right. Like, Trump's not rooted in the military because he...
Not in the least.
He's a fucking, like, soft boy spurs. That, like, he's... probably wouldn't know which end of the gun actually shot the bullet. Actually, yeah. That's probably not true. Yeah. He's watched a lot of fucking shitty action movies.
he'd be able to, like, you know, do the thing that they do on TV sort of thing.
I mean, this dude who couldn't figure out how to close his umbrella, and he just had to set it down.
Throw it down.
I try to imagine that guy.
Somebody will take care of it.
Forget, like, you know, stripping down, cleaning, and putting back together your rifle, right? But just using it, like...
Even the idea of discipline itself is just so utterly anathema.
Yeah, oh, I know.
Who he is as human being.
He's much more akin to, like, classical royalty than, like, the leader of, like, a political upstart movement that's, like, you know,
right.
forged in the flames of social chaos.
Absolutely. But I think the American alt-right sees him as less as an actual embodiment of their, you know, their hopes, of their political hopes, and more so as an opportunistic moment. You know, like an opportunity to grow what they actually want to exist at some point in the future. But I think Jason, you're right. Like every point you're making that about like the things that plague the far right are mirrored by the things that plague the far left. Well, and the things that are lacking are similar.
It's funny that you say that because. Even as you were talking about the way that like the more conscious sort of post-fascist movement thinks of Trump, is also the way that I argue, and that I think some of the most forward-thinking people on the left argue, we should look at Sanders, not like the expression of like what it is we're trying to do, but like you support Sanders because the Sanders moment represents...
Because it's an opportunity.
Right, and a stepping into a new phase and in the possible.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely
right. I think
right.
Everywhere you look, there's a mirror image of, you know, the far left and the far right are developing in the same environment and responding to the same things. And maybe this is why it's useful to understand the post-fascist matrix as such, because it... helps it gives us an easier time, or makes it more concrete when we try to assess the limitations and the possibilities of the left as well.
I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the most primary missing elements is that party formation, and at least outside of the U.S. in the appearance of these post-fascist formations across Europe, I think the existence of a party formation is far more developed on the right than it is on the left. The right, I think, is a step or two big steps ahead of the left, and that is a reason to despair.
It's state-based partly on a Spanish Civil War song. Oh, say, do you remember 25 years ago? They fought the fascist army, they fought the fascist foe. Do you remember Franco, Hitler's old ally? He butchered Spain's democracy, half a million free men died. Aye, 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 did you wonder why? did you